I'm really pleased to see the level of interest that we have in the material that we're going to cover today. I have to apologize, my voice is a little weak, so I'm sitting here with a nice glass of warm tea and some cough drops, and we'll do our best to get through this hour. So today, we'll talk about a bit about the epidemiology of suicide, particularly as it applies to patient care settings, and talk about different ways of detecting suicide risk in those clinical settings, some of the things that can be done in clinical settings, and the training implications of these data. First of all, just a very rough overview, and many of you who've been in this field for a while, you know a lot of these data, so we'll cover these very quickly. We have about 1 million suicides per year worldwide, over 33,000 in the United States, over 1 million attempts in the United States every year, and about a half of those, or a little over half of those, that require significant medical treatment. We have about 8 million adults in the U.S. who would say that they seriously considered suicide sometime during the last year. Males die by suicide about 4 times more frequently than females. The groups that have the highest suicide rates are elderly white males. Other groups that we're really concerned about are working-aged males, who account for about 60% of all suicides. And then American Indian and Alaskan Natives, particularly youth and up into middle age, have suicide rates several times higher than the general population. When we think of suicide attempts, they're much more common among females than males. They reach their peak in adolescence and decline with age. And then two groups that have particularly high suicide attempt rates are young Latinas and LGBT, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgendered, young people and young adults. With regard to patients, when we think of patients in clinical settings, the research shows that 2 to 4% of all the patients that walk into a primary care practice are currently thinking about suicide or about ending their life. Several times more than that, about 10% of the people who walk into emergency departments are thinking of ending their own life. It's important to know that people with a major depression, 10% of them will say that they attempted suicide during a previous major depressive episode. And we'll talk a little bit more about the role of serious mental illness and suicide risk. But it clearly, having any serious mental illness puts someone at several times higher rate of a lifetime risk of suicide. When we think about suicide risk factors, we think about what we call an ecological model, where we think of the individual as having certain risk, actually, and protective factors. Then within the relationships that individual is involved in, there are risk and protective factors. Within communities, there are risk and protective factors. And then in society as a whole, likewise. I want to talk about some risk factors that are particularly important for clinical settings. First of all, it's a patient who is actually involved in suicidal behaviors. Either they've had a previous suicide attempt, or they're currently having suicidal ideation, have developed plans, and have intent to kill themselves. With regard to previous attempts, I would just like to point out that the majority of people who die by suicide do so on their first attempt. So for most people who die, again, there's no opportunity to detect their risk at a suicide attempt because they die on the first attempt. Still, many people who attempt suicide go on to attempt again and again, and sometimes those attempts are lethal. With regard to other factors that can easily be detected in clinical settings, the most important ones, really, are mood disorders, anxiety disorders, and substance abuse disorders. I want to tell you that people who have major depression and people who have alcohol dependence have 20, 30, 40 times higher risk of suicide than the general population. As we move down this list and think of other mental illnesses, physical illnesses, chronic pain, central nervous system disorders such as traumatic brain injury, insomnia, these things elevate a person's suicide risk by 2, 3, 4, 5 times. So they, although they're important indicators of risk, they're at a whole nother level of magnitude, a much lower level of magnitude than major depression and alcohol dependence. Another point I'd like to make about this list is that the risk increases with the severity of symptoms of any of these disorders. It increases with the number of conditions, so that the more you pile on, the higher a person's suicide risk goes. And then a recent onset of these illnesses generally increases the risk more. After a person learns to live with a condition longer, the risk tends to go down. Some other factors that are important to recognize here are impulsivity. So a person who's impulsive would have an increased risk for suicide. And then a group of three characteristics that have been identified by Tom Joyner in a book called Why People Die are failed belongingness, perceived burdensomeness, and a loss of fear of death and pain. If you'd like to read more about those, I encourage you to get his book. And by the way, I get no return on that recommendation. But these are all factors that could definitely be observed in clinical settings. Whether they're as patients begin to tell you a little bit about their story, and as you listen to that story, or just observe their characteristics over time. Protective factors are important as well, and clearly family and community connections, support, social support are all important protective factors. Having access to clinical care, important protective factor. Resilience, coping skills, life skills, frustration tolerance, emotion regulation, and cultural and religious beliefs and spirituality are all factors that have been found by research to be protective against suicide. Some of these, of course, are at the individual level. Some of them are within the context of relationships. Access to community care, for instance, is in the context of community. Now, the next two slides are refer to the warning signs that have been developed by a consensus panel of experts as they looked at the research in this area. And so we have developed and disseminate warning signs for suicide. Now, these are for the public. They weren't intended for clinicians, but they're intended for the public to be looking for these signs. And then if they see someone with these signs, be able to take action. I don't want to spend more time on them here, but we'll mention them a little bit later in the presentation. I would also like to make mention of some triggering events, because for many people, they can have underlying illnesses, underlying risk factors, and then some event comes along that's enough to make them or lead them to taking action to end their life. A lot of times these events involve humiliation, shame, or despair, loss of relationship, and loss or anticipated loss of financial status or health status. So, for instance, if you have a patient who has just gotten bad news about some diagnosis, it's not unreasonable to think that their risk for suicide may be elevated now and that it might be worth asking them about that. So that's a little background for beginning our discussion of linking together this clinical chain of care that would be protective for people of suicide. In order to do this, we've got to be able to detect people who are at risk, assess that risk, manage the suicidality, provide treatment for any underlying mental health problems, and then provide follow-up contact with these individuals. I'd like to take a moment here just to see if you're all awake and paying attention. We're going to put a poll question up and just ask you to vote. We'll give you about 30 seconds here to respond. And then we'll show your answers. So which group is the more serious with regard to elevating suicide risk? Chronic pain, traumatic brain injury, multiple sclerosis, or major depression, alcohol dependence? The vast majority of you got that right. Again, major depression, alcohol dependence put people at 20, 30, 40 times the risk of suicide than the general population, and chronic pain, physical illnesses, traumatic brain injury raise it 2, 3, 4 times, somewhere in that range. So let's go on. We'll take these kinds of polls as we go on, just to keep everyone's attention and to keep you all involved. I'd like to move to a discussion talking about primary care, which is an important setting for detecting suicide risk and managing people who are at elevated risk for suicide or thinking about killing themselves. Why primary care? It turns out that people who die by suicide are twice as likely to have been seen by a primary care provider than a mental health provider in the recent weeks or months prior to their suicide. This is particularly true for men who are much less apt to go to mental health providers than women. So this is an opportunity to reach that group that we talked about, the working age man. There are many key risk factors that we talked about for suicide, which are easily observed in primary care settings, some of the chronic illnesses, chronic pain, and so on. Detecting suicide risk in this setting sits with the chronic disease management model and a patient-centered medical home, which are new trends in the primary care setting. And also, we think of primary care as a place for patient education, educating people about certain health, important health matters. And so, in primary care, for instance, we can educate people about restricting access to lethal means in the home. We can also educate people about the warning signs for suicide risk and the availability of a National Suicide Prevention Lifeline number. I'm going to skip a slide here. I want to just show you here some data that demonstrate that for young people who grow up in a home where guns are unlocked, where guns are locked, ammunition is locked, guns and ammunition are stored in different locations. For these youth, they actually have a statistically significantly lower suicide rate than youth who grow up in guns with homes. So it makes sense that primary care providers, pediatricians, for instance, would educate their parents about the importance of safely storing guns and ammunition in the home. So working with our colleagues at WICHE, which is the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education, we at the Suicide Prevention Resource Center have developed a primary care suicide prevention model. And it recognizes that primary care practices are really a system, and that the whole system needs to be oriented toward this role of preventing suicide. And that simply training primary care providers to detect it would not be sufficient. The reason is that, of course, if you detect in a primary care practice that someone is having active thoughts killing themselves. You can't afford, with a rapid turnover of patients in a primary care practice, just to stop the practice for a few hours while you pay attention to that patient. So the goal here is to develop systems and procedures within the practice of managing this patient while the practice continues to operate. So the model begins with prevention practices that would apply to everyone, and that is teaching the staff how to look for warning signs and some of the key risk factors. For instance, you would want your appointment staff to know that when a person leaves the office and says something like, you know, I won't need a follow-up appointment, and yet this is a person who's been under the care of that practice for a long time, this should be a warning flag. So we want to teach everyone these warning signs and some of the key risk factors. We also want to implement universal depression screening for adults and adolescents. And we probably could also argue for universal screening of alcohol abuse and drug abuse as well. And then patient education, as I just referred to, safe firearm storage and suicide warning signs. It should be something that everyone gets as a matter of normal practice. Then for the intervention itself, when anyone in the clinic notices warning signs, major depression, anxiety, substance abuse, insomnia, chronic pain, again, these things, traumatic brain injury, these things are all things that could be noticed in a typical primary care setting. When they're present, we need to screen for suicidal thoughts. And this can be done as simply as asking one question, which would say, go something like, you know, Mr. Jones, it's not uncommon for someone who's had pain, as severe pain as you've had, and for as long as you've had it, to just get so discouraged that they actually want to end their life. Have you had any thoughts about ending your own life or just wanting to kill yourself? Asking a question in that way normalizes the situation that the patient's in and makes it easier for them to admit to having thoughts that are actually quite stigmatized in our society. So we want to, when we ask the question, however we screen, it could be paper and pencil screening, or it could be asking a question like that, we want to do it in a way that makes it as easy as possible for someone to give the hard answer. When someone says that they have been thinking of suicide, then you've got to have some means of assessing that risk and then managing the risk, initiating some treatment, getting them referred, and we're going to go through discuss some of these different interventions that we are recommending. So we've developed this toolkit with our friends at WICHE to help primary care practices implement a systematic approach to suicide prevention. The toolkit has these six sections, and I'm pleased to tell you it's available in two forms. It's available on our website. You can download it all, print it all out for free. Or if you'd like a really nice color-printed, spiral-bound version, you can order that through WICHE, and the instructions for doing that are also on our website. The first the part of this kit is a get starting quick start guide, and this actually has six steps to it. And the first step is real important, and that is actually to develop this office protocol. So it's basically the staff sits down and figures out who is going to do what, with whom, and how when a patient is identified as having suicidal thoughts. For some practices, this may mean moving the patient to another room where someone can observe them, or having a family member with them, calling a mobile crisis team to come and do an assessment, contacting a mental health provider who can come and do an assessment, or take the patient to a clinic upstairs or whatever. The main thing is that for each practice, they establish all these procedures. How to contact the emergency department if someone is truly in crisis and just needs to go to a hospital. There is a primer in the toolkit divided into 5 modules. The whole thing is about 20 pages long, so it's relatively short. And really, here's all the information that the entire staff would need to know to implement sound suicide prevention practices in that primary care setting. The third part of the toolkit helps the primary care practice reach out to behavioral health providers and develop the kind of relationships that will be necessary to either refer patients or co-manage the patients. And there's a template in here for a letter that you could send to behavioral health providers that basically says, we in our practice are going to be increasing our vigilance for patients who are at risk for suicide, and so we expect to be finding more and we'll be referring more. So we need to develop these relationships. In the letter, there's an insert for the safety card, which is a card that has been developed to help mental health professionals assess suicide risk in their patients. There's also an invitation for the primary care folks to meet with the mental health provider and talk about how they're going to collaboratively manage the patients that they detect. Then the letter concludes with a statement that the National Strategy for Suicide Prevention recommends that all healthcare professionals get additional training in managing these patients and suggests that in our primary care practice, we are increasing, we're getting training ourselves, and you, the behavioral health provider, if you'd like to get more training, here are some outlets for that training that you might want to look into. So that's all in a nice introductory letter. This is just a picture of the safety card, which was developed with our friends at the Screening for Mental Health and Dr. Doug Jacobs. Dr. Jacobs was the editor of the American Psychiatric Association's guidelines for managing suicidal patients, and he's a nationally and internationally renowned expert on the issue. So he helped us develop this little pocket card for mental health professionals and to help assess the risk for them, for their mental health patients. Also to help develop the partnerships in the behavioral health community, we have information in the toolkit about telemental health, developing a telemental health capacity in your community. It's a nice little website. If you're interested, I encourage you to take a look at that. And then also it's important to know that on SAMHSA's website, there is a locator for nearby mental health and substance abuse treatment resources, as well as on the this website. Here we have a veterans resource locator. So if you have a vet that needs care, it's very easy to find the nearest vet facility, including the suicide prevention coordinator that each veterans hospital has. In this toolkit, we've also developed a pocket card for primary care professionals. So it's a little less mental health lingo in this card. And we try to reduce it to the things that are most important to primary care providers. Risk and protective factors. Questions that they can ask to uncover suicidality, to delve into suicide ideation and plans, to delve into suicide intent. And basically, I think it would be very fine for a primary care doc to sit down basically and read these questions and use this as a prompt to have a conversation with a suicidal patient. And then on the basis of that conversation, would be able to use this decision tree to determine if that patient is high risk, moderate risk, low risk, and come up with a treatment plan based on the information in the boxes on this card. Again, this card is downloadable on our website for free, or you can get it with the Witchy toolkit, or actually you can buy the pocket cards separately through Witchy. Let's transition now to talking about the emergency department and how suicide risk might be detected in an emergency department. First of all, be it known that a large proportion of the visits in emergency departments are for people seeking mental health treatment, and many of them are for people who are suicidal or have attempted suicide. We know that about 10 to 12% of the people who walk into an emergency department who are there for medical disorders are also having suicidal ideation. They probably won't mention it unless they're asked. This one research showed that of 1,590 patients that came into an ED, 31 of them walked in with plans, suicide plans, and but the research was only a surveillance research, so although they reported this in a survey before they were treated in the emergency department, no one in the ED was notified that they had these plans. They went back 45 days later and found that of those 31, four had actually attempted suicide and returned to that same emergency department for treatment. From data in South Carolina, we know that 1 out of 10 people who die by suicide had been seen in an emergency department within 2 months of dying. So we know that we can detect a lot of suicidal people in emergency departments if we do a better job at that. At Emory University, they did a study where when people came in the emergency department and weren't so severely injured that they had to be cared for immediately, they went through computer screening. And 165 patients identified themselves as having suicidal thoughts at the time. The physician and the nurse were both informed, and the patient was told that the physician and nurse were informed. 6 months later, they went back to the emergency department and did a record check. And they found that 10% of that 165 had been transferred to psychiatric services. Well, that's good for the 10%. Only 25% had any notation in the chart that they were regarding their suicide risk. So 75% of the patients, even though the physician and the nurse had been told about their suicidal ideation, there was no evidence in the chart of any follow-up being done. 4 of those patients came back to the emergency department again with suicide attempts, and none of them had been there for a mental health problem on the first visit. So we see here that this is probably typical of a lot of emergency departments across the country, and we can see that we're not doing a very good job there in detecting this risk. So we at the Suicide Prevention Resource Center have developed some materials to hopefully help that. We have a poster that we developed to raise awareness, and we've developed a guide for emergency department evaluation and triage that's an 8.5 by 11 guide, two-sided, that will help clinicians walk through the process of asking questions about suicide risk and then making decisions about the level of risk and making discharge recommendations. So let's pause here for another question. Have you ever directly asked someone if he or she was thinking about ending his or her life? I'm guessing that in this group, most people will say that they have, but it will be interesting to see if there are some among us who have never really just looked someone in the eye and asked them if they were at this moment thinking about killing themselves or ending their life. So we see the results of our poll. Ah, most of you have. Well, for the few of you that haven't, I just want to make sure that we all get an opportunity. How do we get to the... And I'd like you to... I'm trying to advance the slide. I'd like you to take a moment and just pick one of these scenarios and get the words out of your mouth using the normalizing technique that I demonstrated a few moments ago. And just think of yourself as sitting with one of these people and saying, you know, it's not unusual for someone who blah, 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 like you to be thinking about suicide. Are you having any of those thoughts? But just say that now. I would just hate for someone to have gone through a presentation like this and still have never had those words come out of your mouth. Because I know it's hard the first time. So we want to make sure everyone has this very, very basic skill. Let's shift now to thinking about in the mental health clinical settings, how suicide can be detected. Clearly, people who are in contact with mental health because they have a mental health problem are at increased risk for suicide. And I'd like to particularly point out this toward the bottom of this slide. People who have been hospitalized for psychiatric illness are, and particularly if they've been hospitalized for an attempt, they are truly hundreds of times higher risk than the general population. And so this is the group that we should be focusing on the most or focused on intently. Data from the Joint Commission also indicate that one of the most common sentinel events is actually a suicide in an inpatient setting. We don't have very good data. We don't know really how many people die by suicide while they're inpatients. But we know that it's significant. And we also know, according to this Joint Commission data, that most of the factors involved here are actually things that are within the control of the facility to change. So we're missing opportunities here to prevent suicide because we're not paying enough attention to these issues. I'd like to also draw your attention to some data that come in through a National Comorbidity Survey that was done in the early 90s and then repeated 10 years later. And this survey of 9,000 some odd respondents indicates that basically the level of suicidal ideation, plans, gestures, and attempts in the population didn't change much over that decade. What did change, though, is that the percentage of people who had suicidal ideation who also got treatment went up significantly, 60 to 100% in these two different categories. So we had about the same number of people in the early 90s and in the early 2000s who have this evidence of suicide risk, and a lot more of them getting treated in the early 2000s. However, we see that the suicide rate remained about flat over that period of time. So we have a lot more people getting treatment, but it doesn't seem to be doing much good. So one of the conclusions of this study was that it appears that people who are at risk for suicide need to be getting much more intensive treatment than is currently being provided. So let's talk about some of the better treatments or more intensive treatment that could be done to these people, for these people. First of all, relatively new on the scene is the idea of safety planning or crisis response planning. This is something that's done collaboratively with a suicidal person. It develops a plan that helps them, first of all, recognize when they're beginning to down the path toward a suicidal crisis. It then establishes a plan of what they will do to manage their own crisis and what then they can do when they find out if they just can't manage it themselves, what they will do to reach out for help. And so with the help of Drs. Greg Brown and Barbara Stanley and the folks at the VA, we have available this safety planning guide to work with a patient to develop the safety plan. Again, this is available on our website. We also talk about what we call a crisis support plan, and this works with the patient and some support person to contract that person to be a support to the individual who's at risk for suicide. So this establishes a support person in the community that knows the person suicidal and that can kind of be their another anchor for them when they're in crisis. Patient tracking is also critical. We know that these people must be followed over time, and that people who are suicidal cannot just be left to their own to make it to the next appointment, let's say if they miss an appointment. This is a sample crisis support plan, which is also available on our website. We also know that in emergency departments, spending time engaging with the patient, talking about suicide attempts, talking about treatment, will actually increase the likelihood that they would follow up on an outpatient basis. So in this emergency department setting, we see people engaging in motivational interviewing techniques, short-term, in the emergency department, one session, cognitive therapy, safety planning, crisis support planning, means restriction education, which are all important interventions that can be done in the emergency department to save lives. I should make a point here about means restriction education. We know that, and this, by the way, is a page from our best practices registry. We know that if ED clinicians sit down with patients, with parents of adolescents, and talk with them about the importance of limiting access to medications, over-the-counter and prescription medications at home, and firearms and so on, that they actually will go home and remove firearms and remove and reduce access to these things. So it's a pretty good evidence base for these kinds of interventions. This is the discharge plan that we have on our emergency department poster. And if we could just get people to follow these four items on a checklist before they discharge any patient who's suicidal, we might see better outcomes. Now, mental health therapies, the better treatment that we were talking about, these are basically the list of evidence-based treatments for people with mental illnesses that we know reduce suicidal behaviors in the future. Unfortunately, the two drugs at the top have their own problems, although they're the only two drugs that have been shown to reduce suicide risk. They're also not the first drugs of choice for bipolar disorder or schizophrenia. They're not the easiest drugs to use, so there are some problems there. The dialectical behavioral therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, and psychodynamic interpersonal therapy are all approaches that have been shown to be quite effective. And probably the biggest barrier we have there is that we need more providers that know how to use them. Follow-up contact is worth spending some time talking about, because probably some of the most effective interventions is actually caring follow-up. We've seen several studies that show that after people were discharged from hospitals or emergency departments, that suicide attempts, or in some cases actual completions by suicide, have been reduced by doing things as simple as periodically sending postcards to patients just to let you know that they're, let them know that you're thinking about them. In fact, this study was done in five different countries, all developing nations outside the United States, a study of 1,867 attempt survivors that showed up in emergency departments for care. In these developing countries, they received no psychiatric evaluation whatsoever. They were given a one-hour discussion of suicide and the usefulness of treatment in the outpatient setting. And then over the next 18 months, they got 9 follow-up contacts, either by phone, calls, or visits. And over those 18 months, death by suicide was reduced by about 90%. It's really rather amazing. So basically, by contacting someone occasionally, someone who has attempted suicide, you could dramatically reduce their risk. Crisis lines our evidence base for crisis lines, suicide hotlines, has increased substantially over the last decade. When the national strategy was written, the evidence was really equivocal as to whether or not crisis lines were effective. But there was some concern that people who were most suicidal didn't call crisis lines, and then we weren't really sure that they helped that much anyway. But now, because of more research that's been done, we know that indeed, seriously, suicidal callers do call crisis lines in meaningful numbers, that when people do call crisis lines, they get better during the course of the call. Their distress goes down, hopelessness goes down, psychological pain goes down, and that actually plans that are developed during the calls, people will follow through on them. And that people are still feeling better a couple weeks later when we follow up with them. And in fact, when these researchers did follow up with people who had called a crisis line, 11% of the callers spontaneously reported that the call had prevented them from killing or hurting themselves. So we see that there is that there's a lot of opportunity here to use crisis lines as a avenue for people who are suicidal to find relief, but also as a way to reach out to people who we already know are suicidal. People with a history of a suicide attempt, and particularly if they leave with an emergency department, say, with an intent to die. And so a couple of years ago, when we were working with state mental health authorities to develop suicide prevention guidelines for them, we've also developed, in the course of that discussion, new role for crisis lines to be playing in providing continuity of care, or as part of this chain of care. So we need to realize that these crisis hotlines can provide some of the continuity of care for at-risk persons outside the traditional behavioral health system. They can provide follow-up contacts, for instance. They can provide access for people in rural areas as well, who can't gain access to mental health treatment. And they can help track people after discharge, either from inpatient care or emergency department care. This slide just shows two of the important patient education pieces, which we believe are important interventions. The brochure on the left is from Washington, University of Washington. It's probably the best brochure that we've seen that educates people on how to safely store firearms, some of the options there. That's available through that website. And then on the right is a pockets or wallet card with the suicide prevention warning signs, and probably most as important, the number for the suicide prevention, National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. And it's time for another poll. So think about the things we've talked about in terms of promising or effective interventions. Which of the following has been shown to be ineffective in preventing suicidal behaviors? And I'll just give you a clue here. It's the one that we did not talk about. And so the point of this poll, of this question, is to highlight to all of you that the practice of engaging in no suicide contracts has been shown not to be effective in preventing suicides. So we did very well there. All of the other practices that we mentioned are either promising or have actually been shown to be effective. It's that the no suicide contract, getting a patient to sign a contract that they will not kill themselves, has been shown to not be effective in preventing suicide. So let's go on. So we've talked about the various settings of care, primary care, mental health, emergency departments, crisis centers, and the importance of detecting risk, assessing risk, managing risk, treating patients, follow-up contact, and all that done in a connected way so that these people who are most vulnerable and probably least able to manage their own lives don't just fall through cracks. We've got to lace together a pretty tight safety net for these people in our care systems. And in order to do this, there are some training implications. Because the fact is, the people that we would expect to be most trained in this aren't, and that's mental health professionals. Most mental health professionals have had no formal training in assessing and managing suicidal patients. And in fact, just within the last year, this study was published, chief psychiatry residents, and we all think of psychiatrists as being the most trained in this area, they were surveyed on 25 different topics that should be covered in their residency programs that are associated with assessing and managing suicide risk. And the majority of the respondents, over the half of the respondents, said that 19 of those 25 topics required more attention in their residency programs. So it's clear that the mental health professional task force, the mental health professional workforce, is not being trained adequately to manage suicidal patients. This is our advertisement for this training, and we want to promote here a training program that we've developed here at the Suicide Prevention Resource Center. It's a one-day workshop that addresses 24 core competencies in assessing and managing suicide risk. There's a great video in here by Dave Jobes demonstrating some of the skills. A nice participant manual, 6.5 hours of CE credits. We have about 100 faculty authorized across the country to provide this training. So this is one option for helping improve the training of the clinicians in your community. And the contact information is there if you're interested. I want to also raise awareness of some of the other trainings out there because we're not the only one. And that the QPR Institute has a 10-hour course available. It's available either online or face-to-face. Our colleagues at the American Association of Suicidology have a 2-day course with a post-workshop mentoring called Recognizing and Responding to Suicide Risk. And then our friends in Canada at Living Works also have a 1-day seminar, Advanced Clinical Practice. And so we would encourage everyone across the country to begin to take action to improve the training of mental health clinicians in their community. I also want to raise your awareness of another tool, and this is a guide that's also available on our website to help healthcare settings implement the Joint Commission's 2007 patient safety goals. So we've provided here an overview of some of the current best practices, the evidence base for assessing and managing suicide risk, and hopefully all of this can kind of go together to help us see how we can make those connections between the various aspects of our healthcare delivery system to provide better care for people who are suicidal and hopefully make significant reductions in attempts and suicide completions. At this point, I'll conclude my comments and we'll turn it over to the moderators who will solicit your questions.
Thank you so much, David. This is Zan again, the project director for the SPRC Training Institute. And actually, before we start taking questions, although you're welcome to start typing them in, we're going to take a moment to see if our discussants, who we've invited to share comments following this presentation, have anything that they want to share in addition to what David's already covered in his presentation. We're fortunate today to have Richard McKeon from the Center for Mental Health Services at SAMHSA on the line, as well as Mort Silverman, Senior Advisor at the Suicide Prevention Resource Center, both of whom have quite a bit of experience in this topic and have been important contributors to SPRC's work around this issue of developing a more effective chain of care. So I believe that both of our discussants have their phone lines open now. I'm not sure who wants to go first, but perhaps we could just turn to you, Dr. Richard McKeon, to hear your thoughts or any comments you want to share at this point.
Sure. Thank you very much, Zan. And thank you, David, for that excellent and comprehensive overview. I think it was extremely worthwhile. Let me just comment on a couple of the areas that were highlighted as part of this presentation. And the part that I would really like to focus on is really the importance of follow-up. What we have really tended to do in mental health, I think, and my background is spent almost 20 years in hospital-based community mental health, including psychiatric emergency services, inpatient services, outpatient services, and others. And I think that a lot of the emphasis and a lot of the costs tend to go to acute interventions. And these include inpatient hospitalization and emergency department care. Yet I think it's really become apparent as research has continued to accumulate that the time after an acute episode of suicide risk is also a time of very significant risk. It would be wonderful if there was something that we could do on an inpatient unit or in an emergency room that had the effect of entirely eliminating suicide risk. We know that that is not the case. We can reduce suicide risk at those times, but not eliminate it. And what becomes clear is that suicide risk appears to be able to be easily triggered again or rekindled in those periods. So it is clear that we need to pay attention to what happens after someone that we've seen walks out the emergency department door? What happens after they are discharged from an inpatient unit? Research from that the VA has done, Dr. Marcia Valenstein and all, has shown that among thousands of VA patients who were hospitalized for depression, that when they looked at what the highest risk periods were, the highest single risk period was the period after discharge from an inpatient unit. Now, one of the issues that I think comes up is that our mental health systems are structurally not designed to provide close follow-up after an emergency department discharge or after an inpatient discharge. The inpatient unit may be in one area or in one agency, one hospital. The outpatient services may be in a totally different facility. And an emergency room could be as part of a third facility. So working together as a coordinated system of care and providing continuity of care during those high-risk periods can be extremely challenging. But I think that what's emerged really from the research is an underscoring of the importance of finding ways to provide that care. One thing that SAMHSA has done is to fund some of the crisis centers who participate in our National Suicide Prevention Lifeline to provide follow-up care for people who call the Lifeline, but also to work with local emergency departments and other programs to be able to provide follow-up after an emergency department discharge. It's not that crisis centers are the only way of providing such care, but they could potentially provide a structural solution to what is in many ways a structural problem. As we know, when someone leaves an emergency department, typically the emergency room's response sees its responsibility as ending. And outpatient programs often do not see their responsibilities as beginning until the person first walks through the door of the outpatient program, unless they have specific funding for that. So this is an issue that we have been trying to look at SAMHSA in order to enhance the continuity of care. And I know that there are a number of people on this call from the Veterans Administration, and the Veterans Administration has certainly been doing hugely important work in trying to improve continuity of care, and having suicide prevention coordinators in each of the VA medical centers who can reach out and assist that veterans who are at risk for suicide don't fall through the cracks of the system. And so we're hoping there's a lot that we can learn from the Veterans Administration in promoting good follow-up systems nationally. But there's a lot that we have left to learn, but it is a crucially important issue given the data that shows that the risk is clearly high after ED and inpatient discharge, but that the rates of follow-ups with services are distressingly low. So that was the area that I wanted to focus on. So thanks for the opportunity, Zan.
Thank you. And I just want to let our participants know that we will leave the lines open for both our presenter and discussants to answer questions. So during Q&A time, whoever wants to speak up first, feel free. And likewise, I did mention that you can go ahead while we're hearing from the discussants to write your questions in the question box on the side of your screen. Just enter the name of the organization you work for and then your question and press send. And I'll be using your entries there to facilitate the Q&A session momentarily. So that said, I'd like to turn to Dr. Mort Silverman and see if you have any comments you'd like to share at this point.
Thanks, Jan. And I did want to also thank David for providing us with a tremendous wealth of information and ideas to think about in terms of how to approach these problems that we all face when dealing with patients at risk for suicide. I wanted to just briefly emphasize the points that Dr. McKeon was making about the importance of the continuity of care for individuals who have been discharged from an emergency department or an inpatient psychiatry unit, and the importance of not only assuring a logical and well thought through process of moving the patient from one system, one healthcare system, to another, but also the importance of patient education and family education that has to be there as well to benefit the patient as they make these transitions from one system to another. And, of course, the importance of communication between and among these various healthcare systems. And it starts with discharge planning, and it starts with ensuring that the information gleaned in the emergency department or learned on an inpatient service gets to the next provider so that the next provider has the information that they need to provide the best possible care. And there are efforts underway to begin to develop some of these mechanisms and to think through how to ensure that when a patient leaves an emergency department or leaves an inpatient service, that they don't get lost in the shuffle of these transitions, and that there are people, family members and others, who are monitoring their care and their transition until they can get to the next step. So I just wanted to emphasize the importance of that one aspect of thinking about how to address patients at risk for suicide and also preventing at-risk individuals from attempting again or tragically dying by suicide. Thank you.
Yeah, and this is David Litz again. Just to piggyback on what Mort just said, a lot of times getting that information to flow between different providers in the community really requires relationship building between those providers so that outpatient service providers have to make time to sit down and talk with the inpatient care providers and the emergency department providers to build mechanisms through which they can share that information so that the discharge summary gets to the outpatient provider before the patient does. And if the patient ends up not getting there, then someone knows that they didn't show up and can go looking for them.
Thank you. We have quite a few questions coming in right now, so I'm going to go ahead and read some of them off in no particular order, and we'll see how many we can get through in our remaining time. One person, Kelly Ledbetter, wanted to ask if you could explain better what telemental health is.
Telemental, I'll take that, I guess. Telemental health is a capacity for someone to be seen by or be evaluated by a mental health provider that's in another location. So it could be via a webcam, ideally. It could be via telephone, but it's nice, of course, if you can get the visual link up as well. Some states are being quite systematic about developing this capacity to serve their rural areas so that you build this video teleconferencing capacity, and you take care of the licensing issues and credentialing issues that are involved so that people can get mental health care across distances.
Great. Thank you very much. And we have a question that may actually be related, but I'll add it since it came in early on in your presentation. Tim Lineweaver, and I apologize in advance to anyone whose name I'm mispronouncing, of the Community Health Center of Cape Cod says, our prevention coalition represents a geographically disparate region, including two islands off the coast. Do you have any suggestions for us to connect care?
My general approach to questions like that are that I found it's amazing what coalitions can do when folks sit down together and define the problem in a way that they all can understand it, and then look within their own resources to figure out how to solve the problem. So I guess I can imagine telemental health, might be part of that solution. But there may be others, too, that that the coalition can come up with.
And I did not. Go ahead, David.
Go ahead. No.
I was going to say that what I'm about to say is nothing new or radical. However, I always think it's important to include in these discussions the consumers themselves and to ask the consumers what are the obstacles that they are experiencing in terms of getting care and ensuring continuity of care. And we need always to involve the consumers themselves and listen to them and incorporate into our planning solutions for the types of difficulties that they're experiencing as well.
Excellent point.
And this is Richard McKeon. Just one other thing that I would mention is supports
what David and Mort have already said, but I really think that there's no substitute for face-to-face meetings. That don't necessarily have to be a lot of them, but on some periodic basis, potentially with either phone or email correspondence in between. So people simply have to be in contact with each other and have some level of knowledge of each other face to face in order to be able to work through what can sometimes be very difficult or challenging issues, particularly around people who are at high risk. In New Jersey, there was, by state law, something called an acute care systems review committee for each county. So each of the components of the acute care system, the inpatient unit, the emergency service, the mobile outreach team, and others, were required to meet monthly, as well as with the state hospital, on a monthly basis. And, I'm not sure that monthly is what is needed, but there needs to be regular meetings between the different parts of the system, because it's really too easy to be caught up in how things affect a particular agency, a particular funding stream, etc., if you're not meeting face-to-face and other agencies are and other programs are more distant. So one way or another, I think that direct contact has to be made on some kind of periodic basis to help keep people working together, because it's not easy to work together in pursuit of a common goal.
Thank you. We also have a question from Cynthia Beavers. She wants to know, what are some suggestions for working with stigma and resistance to suicide prevention in helping settings, especially in colleges and universities?
anyone want to jump on that one?
Well, certainly one option. This is Richard McKeon again.
Certainly one option that has and one sort of potential source of resources is SAMHSA runs a campus suicide prevention grant program, and funding from that can be used for suicide prevention activities, including efforts to reduce stigma. And I think that is really a crucial issue now, because we want to be able to reduce stigma. We want to be able to promote help seeking. And as part of that, we want to understand better, and I think we need to understand better, what is it that keeps people away from, you know, seeking help. And, you know, and there, I think having a system that perhaps relied perhaps not as much on acute interventions, particularly involuntary interventions, which are going to be needed to some degree, but if we relied on them less and had better follow-up systems and better access to outpatient care and in a collaborative approach to services, it might be the case that perhaps some of the fears or concerns about what would happen if you asked for help could be reduced among some people. There's been some research, for example, among high school students that have suggested, well, why don't you tell an adult why that you've heard that a friend was talking about suicide? And one common response was that basically that they were afraid that their friend would be immediately whisked off in a kind of a dramatic emergency kind of intervention. Now, we all know that those kinds of interventions are needed at times, but we want to have a range of services available so that people don't think that is the only thing that the mental health system has to offer.
Great, thank you. We also have a question from Jack Husted, located at a vet center. He asks if someone would address suicide prevention in incarceration settings.
That's an excellent question, and an area that has been understudied and needs more attention. As a matter of fact, there is a psychiatrist at the Denver VA named Hal Wortzel, Wortzel, who has been publishing on this very topic in the last few years, has out a number of papers and is actively working with the legal system in the Denver area to address these concerns. And I would refer you to Hal publications, but also to contact him directly at the VA in Denver to help address any specific issues that you're finding in your own community around this issue. It is one that has been neglected for too long a period of time, and there is a small group of folks out there who are trying to rectify the problems.
I would also say that there are a number of publications in the SPRC online library addressing suicide prevention for incarcerated populations that might be helpful as well. I think it comes down to developing the kinds of environmental safety practices, risk detection practices to monitor and support those people at risk that we've been talking about. But there are also some unique aspects that apply to the incarcerated population.
Thanks. We also received a few questions related to when to hospitalize and when to continue treating in an outpatient setting. So I'll just read a representative one. Kelly Ledbetter asked, how do you know when it gets to the point that someone needs to be hospitalized? I know that's perhaps pointing towards a question more about, do we have any guidelines or information about that?
That's a very difficult question to ask in the abstract, because it often does come down to the relationship that the clinician has with the client, and a sense of whether, based on having already established a relationship over time, whether what's currently going on is different or more worrisome than what has happened in the past. My general rule of thumb, though, is to always think about the situation in terms of safety, and whether the patient can assure you that they will be safe if they leave your office or leave your facility and go back to their home or their community, and to really explore with the individual what it means to be safe and what they need to do to ensure that they will remain safe. And, of course, to set up a safety plan to ensure that there are actions that they can take to get help if they find that they're no longer able to manage their own safety.
Yeah, I would also recommend that the questioner take a look at the safety card that we featured earlier in the presentation. And it, in the abstract, describes what would qualify someone to be designated as a high risk, which would most always require an admission. And then some people at moderate risk may also need admission, and it discusses some of those things as well. Again, to just provide some general guidelines.
Okay, I'm just going to offer one more question, although we've received many questions, and so we'll look at ways to address other questions that have been raised, but which we don't have time to cover right now, and send out an email follow-up about this. But the last question that I'll share is from Franklin Krauss, and the question is, how helpful are the religious and spiritual aspects and organizations in support and prevention?
A real short answer, very, very helpful and very needed. And I think we really do need to reach out to all organizations in a community and all places where people congregate and have an identity and feel that they're part of a group and have strong feelings about being spiritual and participating in those in religious activities. I think it is a very important part of a comprehensive suicide prevention program to involve clergy and to involve churches and mosques and synagogues and temples in thinking about all the different venues, all the different settings where the message can get out and about suicide prevention, and also people can be trained to watch out for each other and provide the needed support and caring that we all need at various times in our lives.
Yeah, all true, definitely. And not too long ago, we featured in the weekly Spark research done with consumers who had a history of suicidal crises, and the consumers themselves identified most often the source where they would go to for relief in their crisis was their faith and spirituality.
Thank you. I also saw a number of questions which I can answer, which I think the main question coming up related to this presentation is where can people get a copy of it? And I want to let everyone know that if you would like to have a PDF copy of this presentation, you can go to, it's available right now on the SPRC website, www.sprc.org. The easiest way to find it is simply to go to that website, click on Training Institute, click on Research to Practice Webinars, click on the name of this webinar, and you'll see at the bottom of that page a hyperlink that says Access the Presentation PDF Slides. Just click on that, and you'll have a complete copy of this presentation to reference in the future and share with your colleagues. We've also recorded this call. Some of you may have heard an automated message about that at the beginning. We will be posting a recording of this webinar on our website as well at the same location. And so if you would like to listen to it again or share that link with your colleagues, please feel free to do so as well. And we will be sending out an email asking all of you to complete a participant feedback form online. It's a very short survey asking you to give us feedback on what you found useful about this, what you're still interested in learning, topics you'd like us to address in future SPRC Research to Practice webinars. So it should take 2 to 3 minutes to fill out that survey, but it really means a lot to us. So please click on the link when you get it. There were also some questions about resources that were mentioned in the original announcement and mentioned during this presentation, the safety pocket card, safety plan, quick guide for clinicians, primary care pocket guide, the suicide risk guide for evaluation and triage used in EDs. And there were a number of other resources that David mentioned were available through SPRC. Again, just go to www.sprc.org, and you should be able to navigate through there to find all of the resources you're interested in finding, either downloadable from our website or links to those resources through the SPRC library, which is online at sprc.org. So that said, I just want to thank our presenter and discussants for taking the time to share this information. I'm sure that if we had the phone off mute for everyone, you'd hear a resounding applause. But I'll just represent the group and say thank you so much for your time, and thanks to everyone who shared comments and questions, and we will be getting back to those of you who have remaining questions that you'd like answered. And please join us for future SPRC Research to Practice webinars. Have a good day.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.
And a real
Thank
pleasure.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.